Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Randall White. In today for Vicky Gonzalez. Have you seen an increase in book bags? It is the time of year when students are wrapping up their summer breaks and preparing to return to class for the new school year. Safety was top of mind the first day of school at Stockton's Stag High, where nearly 4 months ago, 15-year-old Alicia Reynaga was tragically stabbed to death by an intruder. Documents recently obtained by the Stockton Record from the Stockton Unified School District reveal a security booth at the school's main entrance was empty the morning of the attack, and four of the school's seven security guards were absent that day. Stockton Unified's interim superintendent has announced new security measures at the school, including a security monitor at the entrance, expanded gates and fencing, plus a larger police presence. The tragedy at Stag High highlights the many challenges schools face in keeping everyone on campus safe. To better understand these challenges, we're speaking now with Kenneth Trump, no relation to the former president, but he is a president himself. He's president of the National School Safety and Security Services, a consulting firm. And Kenneth, welcome to Insight. Nice to speak with you.
Thanks for having me with you.
So I want to get to the new information about Stockton's Stag High in just a moment. But first, as a national expert on this topic, as we head into a new school year, how are you feeling about school safety in the U.S.?
Well, certainly concerned at what we saw last school year with the social, emotional stressors that kids have, particularly coming back to in-person learning from remote learning in many school communities, is a concern. We saw it manifest in increased aggression, just overall challenges with discipline, and in a number of cases with violence and violent acts in schools, including some possession and use of weapons.
Mm-hmm. And the tragedy in Uvalde, Texas, of course. How has the conversation changed since that?
Well, certainly in the past, in recent years, there have been more questions given to school officials by parents and the school community about whether or not they're prepared for an emergency. With Uvalde, those questions have now expanded to local first responders, in particular law enforcement. And we'll say that our brothers and sisters in law enforcement across the country are certainly well prepared and would respond to best practices differently than we saw in Uvalde. But there's a lot of demonstration of that, a lot of reassurance going on out in school communities. I've never seen so many school active shooter drills and calling in local media to make sure that message gets out as I've seen in the recent months. And I attribute a lot of that to Uvalde. So there's a good deal of unease, anxiousness, ambiguity, and uncertainty. And that's only going to build upon the already existing social emotional stressors and that those challenges that we're dealing with in student behavior and just overall stressors upon everybody related to COVID.
Kenneth, let's look at this from a parent's perspective. A parent preparing for their child to go back for the fall semester, what should they most be concerned about? Are there areas where you would recommend they be vigilant?
Well, I think parents need to ask a lot of questions, a lot of specific questions, and particularly those related to human factors. We know that the first and best line of defense in school safety is a well-trained, highly alert staff and student body. Many schools are, and many state legislatures and governors are kind of throwing some one-time shot in the arm focus on target hardening. Let's get more hardware, more equipment, more bells and whistles, shiny objects. But we know that when I do expert witness work on civil litigation cases, lawsuits on school security incidents, emergency planning, wrongful deaths, the mass shootings. I've worked on Sandy Hook, Parkland, San Bernardino Elementary School case and many others. And while the facts and merits of those cases vary, the common thread is they involve allegations of failures of human factors, people, policies, procedures, and training. So we want to make sure that our school officials are dedicating as much time to the three P's, plan, prepare, and practice. And I would add a fourth, prevention, as they are to putting up the shiny objects, the bells and whistles, the physical security and hardware that they can point to create, in some cases, security theater that makes people feel safer, but doesn't necessarily make them safer.
Yeah, because plan, prepare, and practice, the first three are all for in the event that something terrible happens. But the prevention, that fourth P you mentioned, that's the tricky one, right? How do you keep that from happening?
Well, the good news is school officials are much better prepared than they were 10, 20, 30 years ago over the three decades I've worked in school safety. They're much better prepared at preventing incidents, the ones that we'll never hear about. The work that they do every day, from teen suicide prevention to preventing kids that have weapons in schools from committing any type of act, those are the ones you don't hear about. The bad news is we still have incidents that slip through the cracks. And I will say that this school year and others, and particularly related to the Stockton incident and examples of like Uvalde, we're stressing in the training that I'm doing, speaking at superintendent, principal, school board, teacher conferences around the country on a different area, not just training to the emergency checklist, but training on three other areas. Number one, situational awareness, having people more mindful when they're supervising kids, a bus drop off and pick up, athletic events, cafeteria, outside the campus, being mindful of their surroundings. Number two, pattern recognition, looking for abnormalities, things that stand out, the strange car, the strange person, different changes of behavior in kids. And the third part is cognitive decision-making under stress. We make decisions in education through collaboration committees, studying all the best options, and then acting in a critical incident. You need to make sure that people are situationally aware, recognize abnormalities, and then make the decision that works at that time. Mm-hmm. So we have some different decision-making models as well. Whole different type of strain training for what we call those unknown unknowns, the stranger that does come in that you could never foresee or may not be able to foresee coming or have a specific threat.
Kenneth, there must be a mountain of data out there around all of these incidents and such. Is the Sacramento area or California, or let me say it this way, where on the safety spectrum might the Sacramento area or California fall?
Well, that's the interesting part. There is a lot of information, and a lot of the best practices that were established in this field were established after the Columbine tragedy in Colorado more than two decades ago. For those of us who have been around in this field, we know a lot of those best practices there. But we also know we have a whole new generation of superintendents, principals, teachers, school resource officers, prevention personnel who were not even in those jobs at the time of Columbine. Many of them were just in college themselves, and they have not been trained or retrained on those best practices. So I say that you have to evaluate each school and each school district on a case-by-case basis, take a look at the physical security piece, but also look at the preparedness piece. And that can vary school to school, district to district, and even over time vary within the same schools based on changes of leadership as to whether or not there's a strong emphasis on this and that there's a dedication as much for time for the staff development and training and planning and prevention efforts as there is on putting up the shiny objects, the physical security, and the hardware.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Kenneth Trump with National School Safety Services about campus safety ahead of the new school year. He is a nationally recognized expert when it comes to this topic. And I do want to bring up Stockton, where a recent report in the Stockton Record shows some security issues at Stag High the day a student was tragically stabbed to death last spring. Kenneth, what stands out to you the most about what happened?
Well, I should preface my comments by saying I have no direct involvement in this, either consulting or as an expert witness on the litigation end at this point. But I know that when we evaluate these cases after an incident, the things that we look at is, first of all, were there disconnects between policies, paper, what you say you're doing, and what you are actually doing in practice? And a lot of times we find that in those cases, doing a forensic analysis for civil civil litigation after the fact, we see that the allegations focus on alleged failures of people, policies, procedures, training, the human piece, not necessarily the hardware and equipment. So the questions to that would be, were there any type of warning signs? On your response to that, were you reasonably prepared, did with security measures and response measures, did you do what you say you were doing or what on paper said that you were doing for security and emergency preparedness? And were there any disconnects?
As we mentioned in the introduction, more than half of the campus security guards were absent the day of the fatal stabbing. How common are these staffing issues in your experience?
Well, we are seeing some indicators around the country that just like many other positions in today's society, there are hard to fill. I guess the question there is what protocols, if any, were in place to fill those? Do you have substitute pool, additional people that could cover those spots? If it's not the security personnel, did you have staff members who are on free periods that you could use to put into those positions to serve that supervisory role at that point in time? But we also know that school safety in general, not specific to this incident, tends to be the first area that's cut. We cut our school police, our school security officers, and emergency planning personnel when the budget comes up, because quite frankly, it's a school security in general and school security specifically is a roller coaster situation. It's roller coaster public awareness, public policy, and public funding. Never is there a greater attention to school security in a school community or any other industry than in the days and weeks after a high profile incident. But it's not a question of a wake up call. It's 6 months or 6 years down the road. Will they fall asleep and go back and hit the snooze button and go back to sleep again?
And on your note of cuts, a year before the stabbing, Stockton Unified had eliminated a key position related to school safety, citing a lack of funding. Last month, the school board approved reinstating this position, but funding for it hasn't been determined. So does it always come down to funding for this?
Well, funding can be a convenient excuse, not necessarily. I can't speak to the details of this case, but let's take a look at this, really. School leaders, school board superintendents can say in their rhetoric that school safety is a priority, but if it's not reflected in their budgets and in their allocation of time, then it's just rhetoric. And we see a lot of that around the country. We see many schools that are doing the right things, doing the best they can, dedicating resources, dedicating time. I don't want to paint a broad brush stroke, but I also find run into districts where it is done on the cheap, and it is something that falls to the back burner until a crisis occurs. And if you take the overall budget, operating budget of a school district, and you divide the salary of a school resource officer, an emergency planning person, or even a campus safety monitor, you divide that into the whole operating budget, it ends up being like 0.000000 whatever percent of the overall budget. So just as we allocate funds for custodians and food service workers and office staff and teachers, we need to say that if school safety is really a priority, then we need to allocate the funding and not make it roller coaster just when it comes into focus after a high profile incident.
Kenneth, I know you're up against the clock because you have another interview coming. Do you have time for one more question?
Sure, absolutely. We've got time.
So you mentioned an increase in these training sessions, like lockdown drills. Students and staff prepare, of course, for emergencies during this. Nearly 2 in 10 students reported anxiety related to the drills, according to the California Department of Education in a recent study they did. What's the best way to train for this type of on-campus violence without causing unnecessary emotional harm?
Well, I'm an advocate for traditional basic fundamental drills, a traditional lockdown, police controlled evacuation, shelter in place, and of course your other weather and natural disaster drills. And they need to be age developmentally appropriate. I am not a supporter of over the top drills, run, hide, fight, ones where they're extremely dramatic. And school psychologists, including the National Association of School Psychologists, has increasingly raised issues and concerns of do no harm. Make sure that your drills don't go over the top and do more harm with kids, cause increased anxiety. I think that some of the numbers we look at are actually probably low in terms of the amount of anxiety that's caused for a statistically rare incident. Yes, we want to be prepared, but we don't want to do any harm to kids. And there are a lot of kids that come to school with a lot of social, emotional stress, some anxieties, children who have special needs, and various disabilities that we have to take into consideration with this. And a lot of times we don't see it being done. We're doing a lot of these drills. And it's interesting, there are schools that are calling for run, hide, fight, teaching kids to attack the gunman, throw things, run all over the place, creating a target-rich environment, in my opinion. But yet those same schools won't do a lockdown during lunch period because it's inconvenient. And the only time they do lockdowns or fire drills is at 9 o'clock in the morning, when yet in their schools, they spend hours, some in most days, running lunches, but they won't prepare for that. So focus on those fundamentals, diversify your drills, do a lockdown during lunch between class changes, block a fire exit by standing there and saying, pretend the fire's here, go a different route. Those things you can diversify your drills without creating trauma and causing more harm to kids.
Important information, so I appreciate you staying a little bit longer there. Kenneth Trump is president of the National School Safety and Security Services. It's a national organization that specializes in school safety. Thank you so much for your time today.
Hey, good to be with you. Thank you.
Okay, up next, we turn our attention to North Sacramento and why some residents say the area has long been neglected and allowed to, in some ways, spiral out of control. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station. This is CAP Radio. I'm Randall White.